Hey there, you're listening to the Conservation Spotlight, a regular segment of Willamette Wake Up on KMUZ Community Radio, 88.5 and 100.7 FM, and streaming at KMUZ.org. This is where Marion and Polk Soil and Water Conservation Districts and OSU Small Farms Program shine a light on partnerships and programs that conserve our beautiful natural resources in the Willamette Valley. We are illuminating our collective mission on conserving soil, water, and natural resources for urban and agricultural audiences in the Willamette Valley.
I am your host, Morgan Neal, Outreach Coordinator with the Polk Soil and Water Conservation District. Today, I'm talking with Harry Fuller, author of several natural history books, guide and member of the Salem Audubon Society, and overall bird expert. I'm happy to introduce Harry to everyone today on Conservation Spotlight to have this really exciting conversation about the relationship between birds and conservation. So welcome to the podcast, Harry.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Harry, we first connected through the Salem Audubon Society, and I had reached out to see if a member would be interested in leading bird walks at our property, Cornerstone. And since then, you've led four bird walks for us, and I've learned more than I thought there was to know about birds. So I'd like to begin with a little introduction. If you could share a little bit about yourself, your background, and what drives you and your love for all things birds.
Well, I grew up on a small farm in the Midwest. My dad wasn't a farmer. He was a professor, but he and my mother had both grown up on farms. So they had a farm. That was their hobby. They stayed home and farmed. So we had cows and sheep and chickens. And of course, there were birds all around. So even though I wasn't taught or pushed in that direction, the birds were a part of our daily life all the time. And as a result of that, they were sort of in the back of my mind. And during my career, I've spent most of my time working inside in office buildings where you couldn't even open the window. And I really hankered to do something in my own free time that was outdoors. And I had recalled having that birding experience years earlier, and I started going on Audubon bird walks. We lived in San Francisco at the time, and I found a guy who was a natural teacher. And so I wanted to know everything I could, and I could ask him questions. How'd you know that was a house finch and not a purple finch? And he would answer them in really clear ways. So I really started picking up on information, which has always been sort of the core of my being anyway. And he was just a brilliant mentor, and it really got me into birding. And frankly, the more you learn about them, the more you realize you need to know, because they are very complicated and very interesting. And each species has its own unique characteristics.
Totally agreed. Yeah. I mean, I feel like the more I know, the more I don't know about birds. I think most birders, they will never be bored because there is just so much to learn.
You know, there's almost 10,000 species on this planet. A young man from Noah Stryker from Cottage Grove went around the world, did a big year, and had over 6,000 species in 365 days. So there's no limit to what you can learn, what you can see, and quite frankly, to what you can enjoy.
On our bird walks, I've noticed that one of your teaching methods is storytelling. And I love that because I think a lot of people associate memories with particular birds. And I know for myself, one of my favorite childhood memories growing up in Illinois with my family was our annual spring robin contest. We'd be on the lookout for the first sign of spring to get bragging rights. For a lot of people, birds can evoke emotions and they inspire art and songs. And I really think birds help us to connect with nature and develop curiosity of our environment. So let's lean into that curiosity a bit. Harry, I want to give our listeners the big picture with birds, and then we can dive deeper into some of these topics. So why should we really think of birds as our feathered friends? Or in other words, why are they important and what role do they play in conservation?
They have played in human history. I think they have played probably as an important role as any non-domesticated animals, perhaps not quite as much as dog or eventually horse, but certainly in terms of culture, beliefs, myths, And frankly, understanding what's going on in the world, birds have been really critical for our ancestors for probably thousands, if not millions of years. There's real evidence that probably the first musical instruments were made to try to imitate what they were hearing from birds. I don't think there's any question that our ancestors picked up song, music, rhythm from everything from woodpeckers to thrushes. There's stuff in nature that wouldn't be there without birds. In terms of the environment, they are both indicators of what's going on, and they, quite frankly, in many ways, control it maybe as much as we do. There's clear evidence now that almost every oak forest on the planet was planted by a member of the crow and jay family because they know how to plant acorns. They've been working with oaks for millions of years. There was this test done recently in England. They had 60 acres. They wanted to restore it. So they hired a restoration company run by human beings, and they planted 30 acres, and they left the other 30 acres open, and the jays planted it. And the jays' forest is infinitely better than the one that was planted by human, quote, experts, unquote. Jays know what they're doing, and that's true across the board. They're, in some ways, the birds probably know more about the environment than the best scientists on the planet, and they've learned it over millions of years, and they pass it on. Either genetically or culturally, if you're a raven, you know, you're teaching your kids what to do and how to do it, at least as well as most primates. So there's a lot to be learned, and they will tell us, and they are telling us, when things are in trouble.
What are some of the other ways that birds are helping to keep the ecosystem in balance?
Well, first of all, probably most importantly, for those of us who live in temperate climates, the number of mosquitoes and other insects that are eaten regularly by swallows, swifts, nightjars is enormous. I've seen an estimate recently that a pair of common nighthawks, which are pretty common east of the Cascades here in Oregon, I see a lot of them when I go to Mount Hare, they can feed over 5,000 mosquitoes to their young in a single day. Put that up against spraying all kinds of toxics into the environment. It's like, I think I'd take a couple of night jars any day to a jar full of any poison you can name. Birds do an enormous amount to sort of control and shape the environment. It's not just the fruit they eat and the seeds they poop out or the acorns they plant or the insects they eat, but it's almost everything they do, from nest building to alerting other animals when there's danger. Like in our neighborhood, we have crows and jays. If ever a hawk comes by, every animal within half a block knows it because the crows are screaming and the jays are scolding. And there's no question, that's a red tail or that's a Cooper's hawk. I mean, they all know that. And they are incredibly good at watching, communicating. And the more we listen, the more we can learn because they see what's going on.
One of the birds that I love to hear you talk about is the turkey vulture, which I think kind of gets a bad rap as being a scavenger. Can you share with our listeners how the scavengers help with the balance of our ecosystem too?
Absolutely. The turkey vulture during warm months here in the Willamette Valley is probably the critical cleanup crew for roadkill. Roadkill has become a huge issue across the planet because we drive all the time. And anytime you're going more than about 25 miles an hour, the roadkill rate goes up and they clean that stuff up. They also have evolved to the point where they can eat birds that have been killed by a number of diseases because they are immune. So rather than leaving a carcass around to rot and kill 15 other crows or a whole flock of geese, they'll clean it up. And the environment is therefore safer and better for the survivors. They do a lot of work that is really important. And I think, interestingly enough, they're going to be a clear indicator of climate change. Already a few seem to be wintering now in the Willamette Valley. 100 years ago, that never would have happened. Turkey vultures cannot eat frozen meat. It needs to be thawed out. So in traditionally, they had to go at least as far as Redding, where meat would thaw out during the day. But as we get warmer and warmer winters, I think you're going to see more and more turkey vultures going, why the heck should I fly all the way to California? I can stay here and eat along I-5. And so I think you're like some of the other more cold tolerant species. They only left because they couldn't find enough to eat that wasn't frozen. But that's going to change. And I think you're going to see more of them. I think in 30 years, there'll be a common bird on every Christmas count.
We have a native plant sale that we do twice a year, so native plants are on my mind right now. I was wondering if you could talk about the relationship between birds and native plants.
Yes. First of all, the birds understand the native plants. They know which ones they can eat, which ones they can't. They know when the fruit is ripe and when it isn't. I mean, it's almost amazing, not quite mystical, but almost, to watch waxwings or robins. They'll check out a neighborhood and they'll just keep going. And then all of a sudden they'll decide today the crab apples or the hawthorn or the cotton cotoneaster or whatever it is ripe. And they'll come in and just clean it out. And then they're done and they won't come back for another year. I don't know how they do it, but they do it and they do it regularly. And so native plants, particularly things like oaks, which if you get a grove of oak, it's probably the richest habitat possible in the Willamette Valley. It supports all kinds of other plants. It supports fungus. It supports mistletoe. It supports insects. And it supports a lot of birds. And it's wood that doesn't rot easily. So if a limb breaks off, all of a sudden you've got a hollow area and squirrels or woodpeckers or nuthatches can nest in there for decades. So the oak tree, which was the basis of the habitat here going back for decades, probably to the last ice age, is really critical. And a lot of the birds that live around oaks understand how to use them. They know how to use acorns, how to store them. We're talking about jays, know how to plant them. And so the birds and the particularly the plants and the sort of ground cover and the insects that are around them and the both the vertebrates and the invertebrates are all in a really complex relationship. But in many cases, the birds are the dominant creature. You know, if a kestrel's in a field of grass, he and his wife are going to determine how many voles survive the summer. They're going to be the dominant predator on the small mammals. And you just multiply that by every species, and that's the way it goes. It's the robins that spread mistletoe. They eat the fruit, then they sit on a branch, they poop out the seed, and it's got glue on it, so it sticks to the branch, and now you got more mistletoe. That's how the mistletoe spreads. Robins do it. And you just start looking at every species of bird, and you go, oh my goodness, how could that possibly change if those birds weren't around? And the fact is, much of the ecosystem in the Willamette Valley is totally dependent on birds.
Yeah, you mentioned that some species of birds are considered indicator species.
Yes.
What are some of those indicator species in the valley that we should be concerned with?
Well, probably the most important family of indicator species in this valley would be swallows. Each species of swallow has a different kind of habitat where it likes to nest. The barn swallow, of course, as the name implies, sort of likes towns, and it'll move into your porch if you let it. Some of the others either need trees or need wide open space. But because they are on the wing insect eaters, as their population continues to thrive, and we don't dock down their nest because we don't want them pooping on our front porch, then they are an indicator that there is enough insect life around here to support them. When swallow populations start to drop, that's a really bad sign because that means a lot of the insects, many of which are able to fly, that population is starting to drop. And when that happens, you're talking about lack of pollinators, lack of predators on insects that eat plants. You know, if the ladybug population collapses, you're going to have aphids on every plant in your garden. And the birds, swallows are a classic example of that. I think another good example would be any kind of native bird that likes marshes, whether it's the green heron or mallards or killdeer. If those birds start to disappear from an area, that's a real danger sign because they really know how healthy a marsh is. Is there food? Is the water clean enough that I can swim in it or eat algae off the surface? So those are birds that are really important. Some birds are so flexible that they don't really tell you much. They'll just move. You know, gang of crows, some site that they've been eating at suddenly turns worthless or dangerous, they'll move somewhere else. But a lot of birds are very specific to the kind of habitat they need. And those are the ones that are going to indicate to you is this oak forest okay? If the acorn woodpeckers disappear from a 20-acre oak forest, that's a bad sign.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And what are some of the biggest challenges that birds are facing that's getting the most attention right now in the birding community?
Well, there's a huge number. It's a long list. Obviously, climate change is critical, particularly for birds that aren't as flexible. Birds that are dependent, say, on a certain kind of habitat or a certain set of plants. Those plants have trouble. I think one of the most fragile birds in Oregon is the Clark's Nutcracker, which lives in the mountains and depends on pine cones. We know that pine trees are in trouble. If that forest becomes cedar or oak or Douglas fir or spruce, the Clark's Nutcracker starves to death. So the ones that are really specific about what they need are going to have a lot of trouble. The more flexible birds are probably going to do okay, or at least they'll move further north as long as they can. But some of the other issues are noise and air pollution and too much light. It's really hard this time of year on migrating birds. The light attracts them. And in many cases, it attracts the moths that they're eating if they're flying at night and they're insect eaters. And the lights often draw them into buildings, draw them even worse into broadcast or towers with lines of cable that they can't see at night. Towers are really horrible nighttime migrant killers. And then it's the way we use the land, both paving it or polluting it with dangerous chemicals. The single largest group of endangered birds in North America are birds that really depend on grassland. They can't deal with cattle. They can't deal with mowing. They certainly can't deal with pavement. They need grassland and low shrubs that don't get taken out or burned in the summer. The Native Americans used to burn in the fall, but by that time, all nesting was over. And so it actually helped prevent grassland from becoming shrubs. Kept the manzanita and the ceanothus and stuff down. But now the way we use grasslands, we either farm the heck out of it because we can make money doing that, or we pave it over because we need another shopping center or an airport or a parking lot or football stadium or whatever. And the grassland birds across America, across the whole continent of North America, are suffering the most. We have stopped a lot of the destruction of wetland that was going on like crazy in the first half of the 20th century because we now have wildlife refuges, which, by the way, is one of the greatest American inventions on the planet. And we can thank Teddy Roosevelt for that. And the refuges have helped waterfowl and birds that need water, like herons and egrets and ibis, survive. But we have done almost nothing to try to save grassland because it's too easy to turn it into money. And if we don't reverse that, the Eastern Coast is going to lose their meadowlark, and a lot of other birds like bobolinks are just going to go away. And it's not just happening here. It's happening all across Europe and other parts of developing economies. Grassland is the easiest thing to convert to profit, and so people do it. And the birds are the ones that pay the price.
You mentioned the bird migration, and I definitely Yes. want to elaborate on that too. But just a quick update, if you're just joining us, I'm here with Harry Fuller, author and guide and member of the Salem Audubon Society and overall bird expert. And you're listening to Conservation Spotlight, a regular segment of Willamette Wake Up on KMUZ Community Radio, 88.5 and 100.7 FM, and streaming on KMUZ.org. Harry, there are two big bird migrations a year, one in the spring and one in the fall. Can you share with our listeners what is going on 10,000 feet above us?
Yes. Actually, I prefer to call them the pre-breeding and post-breeding migration.
Okay.
Here in Western Oregon, some of our birds, when they're done breeding, leave as early as August. Some of the birds who breed in the Arctic, like medium and small size shorebirds, actually start migrating down from the North Slope as early as the end of June. And they start showing up here in July. So we're starting to get adult birds down from Alaska on some of our wildlife refuges around here as early as the 4th of July. And what happens up there is they go up early. The minute the snow has melted, they lay their eggs. They've already courted and mated. So they lay their eggs the minute they can, and then the babies have to grow as fast as they can while there's still lots of insects. And because it's 24 hours a day sunshine, there's a lot of insects and it's very intense. So the adults help feed the babies. And then when the babies are big enough to feed themselves, mom and dad leave so the kids can have all the bugs. And so they're flying down through the Willamette Valley in July. And, you know, Sally and Sam, that are now 8 weeks old, are still up in the Arctic feeding and growing and putting on body mass and growing muscles so they can also fly 4,000 miles. Down to Latin America. So we start to get migrants here as early as July. Most of our birds that breed here and then migrate out tend to be more dependent on insects. Not all of them, but most of them are insect eaters. And so, of course, when you get in a cold, wet winter, there's not that many bugs. So they head further south where it's warmer. Swallows, swifts, flycatchers, warblers, some of the thrushes, some sparrows. And they get out of here because it's hard to make a living. And their diet is narrow enough that if they can't get enough bugs, they can't do it. And so many of them start leaving by mid to late August. And even before they leave, there's a period after nesting when young birds and even adult birds start moving around. The ones that are more nomadic can show up almost anywhere on Labor Day. A bird that may have nested at 5,000 feet suddenly is in your yard at 200 feet because it came down out of the mountains, and 2 days from now, it's going to fly down to Crescent City or Redding or something. But right now, it's just down here porking up. It's putting on more body mass. And if you've got the right kind of food in your garden, that's where they are. So, and that migration continues really until October. Some of the last birds that show up are ducks that don't leave the Arctic nesting area like bufflehead until it starts to freeze. So they'll stay up there and eat and pork up and eat another fish and have two more fish for dinner. And they won't leave until they're really basically forced to. So it really depends by species what's going to happen. And then there are the birds that migrate every year, but you never know. There are particularly the finch family is full of these birds that are completely unpredictable. One year you may have 60 siskins at your feeder. The next year, you won't see a one the whole winter. Why? Because the siskins, for whatever reason known only to siskins, have decided the food is better at X than it is where you are. Last year, there were no siskins in Salem. I think we had two on the Christmas count. The year before, I had 60 in my garden all winter. So I have no idea what they're going to do this year, and neither do you, but they've already figured it out, and they're on their way wherever they're going. Yeah. So it really depends. Some birds are quite predictable. We know from mist netting and bird banding at Lucky Butte that there are specific birds that come back to a specific bush every year. They've got one bird that they have trapped on the same net in the same location 6 years in a row. That bird never varies, and it probably does the same thing in the winter. It flies to a certain shrub somewhere in Guatemala and spends the whole winter there, and it comes right back to the same shrub at Lucky Butte. So it really varies by species, how predictable and how ordinary they are. Some birds fly extremely high. They have found that swifts can go up to 10,000 feet or more and will eat aerial plankton, which is stuff floating around the atmosphere that never comes to Earth. Small spiders, mites, insects, moss, bits of plant particle that just floats up there. And they go up there and fill their stomach with that stuff. And they can migrate in the daytime. A lot of migrants that are what you would call songbirds, from jays on down to warblers in size, they migrate at night because it's safer. There's not a falcon that can hunt at night. So they can outfly any owl on the planet. So it's safer if you're a small bird to migrate at night. But that means in the morning when they've landed somewhere, they're starving. So there's the morning after migration where they're all over the place and they're feeding as fast as they can so they can build up their body strength in case they need to take off again the next night. But swallows and swifts that are really fast, and then the big birds, geese, cranes, ducks, hawks, will migrate in the daytime. But we now know that cranes can go up to 30,000 feet. They fly over the Himalayas. And the ones here, I've seen them go over the Siskiyou Pass near Ashland at 6,000 or 7,000 feet in the air. You hear them bugling. But you have to look for these little gray spots way up in the sky. So there are some birds that can go really, really high. Most songbirds, like a swallow or a thrush, will fly 200 or 300 feet up. But there are birds that can go way up. They know about swifts now that they can actually, like albatross, sleep while they fly. They put half the body, half the brain asleep,
Wow.
and they can just fly nonstop. They now know that the common swift, which is like our chimney swift in the East Coast, but it's in Europe and Asia and Africa, can fly for 10 months without landing. Never lands anywhere, just flies.
That's
and
amazing.
they know albatross can fly thousands of miles from Midway to our coast and back again. That's how they commute. They come here and feed, then they take the food back and give it to the mom and the baby in Midway. And they make that flight nonstop. Half the brain goes to sleep and the body rests, and the other half takes over.
Amazing creatures.
Yeah, amazing.
I know that you were instrumental in the installation of the MODIS network at the Ankeny Hill Nature Center. How does this technology contribute to understanding bird migration?
Well, it's fairly new. It's all digital and tiny little transmitters that can be glued onto the back of a bird and not hurt it. And it's been exciting. It's been up almost a year. But right now, in fact, just early the first day this month, we picked up two more migrating Swainson's thrushes. So we have now picked up 9 migrating Swainson's thrushes. Every
cool.
one of them has come south through Vancouver, where they were tagged, Vancouver, British Columbia, and they're heading south. We already know that one was tagged 2 years ago, and it spent last winter in Guatemala and then headed back north. And we know that Swainson's thrushes like fairly wet habitat. So the Willamette Valley is ideal for them. We've got marshes, we've got big trees, and clearly Ankeny is maybe a mile or two from the Willamette. So it's a perfect kind of place if you're a Swainson's thrush. Now, as far as we know, all the ones we picked up have never stopped. They just do flyby and then they're gone. Because the tower can pick up these electric signals from the little glued on transmitter up to about 12 miles. And none of these birds has stuck around. One of the birds that we picked up last winter was a robin that came down from probably Alaska, from what we can gather from the map of where it was picked up. And it spent about 6 weeks, about 5 weeks at Ankeny. And it was obviously feeding. And then the next thing we know, it's back up in the Seattle area in late winter, slowly heading back north. A lot of these birds, you know, they don't have to do a long 3,000-mile flight in 4 days. They tend to go a distance, then stay there and feed and build their body strength back. And then maybe they'll fly another stage. And particularly with the robin, all they got to do is stay away from the snow line. So as long as they don't fly past where the snow line is, they can do really well because they can eat all kinds of stuff as long as they can get to the ground. So they can spend March in Seattle and half of April somewhere in the coast of British Columbia. They may not have to get back to Alaska where they're going to nest until early May or late May, depending on where the snow line is.
And bird research, you know, it's not just for wildlife biologists and conservationists. In what ways can the everyday person contribute to bird research, Harry?
Well, there's all kinds of citizens' participation programs. The oldest and probably the best, certainly with the deepest history, is the Christmas Bird Count, which actually started in 1900. It was starting by an American ornithologist in New York City, and there were 13 people that took part. Now there are thousands all over the world. So it's not only the oldest, but it's the largest and most widespread of any of the citizen science things. And it's the information is extremely rich. Recently, I was working on a book about birding in Harney County, and you look at the old Christmas counts from the 60s, 70s, and 80s, and then what we see now, and it goes, oh, wow, they didn't have that bird, or we have that bird, but we only have a tenth of what they used to get. The other things, there's feeder counts. There are raptor runs where people do them in spring, winter, and fall, where they do a specific route, and they check for all raptors that can be seen. And eBird, of course, now is the biggest major source of bird data on the planet. There are millions of contributors. There are, I don't know, hundreds of millions of records. I mean, I alone have over 10,000 checklists of places I've birded in the last 15 years. And I'm far from being an eBird fanatic. I know people who are doing eBird when they're in the field. So by the time they get home, they've already got their whole checklist online. And I know people who now look for rarities and they go on eBird and say, has this species showed up anywhere in Oregon? And they know within seconds that somebody has just seen one in Wallowa or wherever. So eBird is huge. It's nonprofit. It's run by Cornell and an alliance of bird and conservation groups.
Harry, if you could ask the community to make one change to support bird conservation, what would that be?
Save as much unspoiled open land as possible wherever. It doesn't really matter what the habitat is. And it's not just not farming it or paving it. It's try to let it be natural. And the more that land, the better. Everything from bicycles to cows, plows and mowers, soccer games, golf courses, all those things are artificial. Some birds can deal with them, but other birds can't. It's really important that we save open land. In this area also, obviously, oak trees have an incredible value for a wide spectrum of other plants and wildlife. So as much of that as we can save, the better.
That. Yeah. And I think people can, you know, create these natural spaces even in their own backyards.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's easy to find information. You can go to an Audubon Society or Cornell website and find all kinds of information about the plants you should put in your garden, depending on where you live.
Yeah. Well, Harry, the time flew by. I want to thank you for taking the time to chat with me today. I really appreciate it.
Great. It's been fun.
I've been talking with Harry Fuller about the relationship between birds and conservation, and I'm your host, Morgan Neal, Outreach Coordinator for the Polk SWCD. Thank you for taking a few minutes to share the light with us. We're grateful for a community of conservation-minded folks who know the importance of partnerships. If you would like more information on any of these topics and upcoming events, please visit our website, polkswcd.com, and our Facebook page for follow-up information, including some of these resources and websites that we mentioned, a link to Harry's blog, and I'll also post a link to a webinar recording that Harry did with us a bit ago called The Birds of Cornerstone. And if you liked what you heard here on the Conservation Spotlight, tune in to KMUZ at 100.7 or 88.5 FM the third Wednesday of every month during Willamette Wake Up. Thanks for listening and your light shining.